Selena here, coming to you to let you know that today is my birthday. I mean, not today when I'm recording this, but today when this episode drops. So in honor of my birthday, I wanted to ask for donations, not to our podcast, but to some agencies that are fighting for trans rights, the Black Lives Matter movement, and it's Pride Month, which I love that my birthday falls in Pride Month. And so organizations that help the LGBTQ community. So links to the organizations I picked to donate to will be on our website. So check it out at www.stateofmurder.com. Thanks, guys.
And happy birthday, Selena.
Thank you. Hey, State of Murder fans, family. We don't have a nickname for our listeners.
Usually on our blog, I put SOMers or just SOM family.
Oh, I like it. All right. Hey, SOMers. It's Selena.
And Amber.
And things look a little different this week. But those of you waiting for Kansas, don't worry. We're getting to you guys next week. But we thought Oklahoma was a little bit more relevant to current events happening right now, since it is going to be the place where 2 days after this episode drops, the president is going to give a speech in Oklahoma.
One of his rallies. I don't even know what you want to call them. Bullshit.
They're rallies, I guess.
Yeah. So propaganda. He's having a...
Yeah. So my story this week is on the Tulsa race massacre, which you may or may not have heard of, starting to come into light because of the rally that's taking place in a few days. So we thought we'd bump Oklahoma up on the list just this once. We are going to have them out of order. And then Kansas, you'll get your episode next week. So thanks, guys. Hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to State of Murder. We are in Oklahoma this week.
Yeah, we are. I have been to Oklahoma.
I have not.
My freshman year of college, my roommate Karenza is from a very small town outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma. So we went to her house during spring break, our freshman year, I believe it was, and spent some time in her hometown. And then we went to Tulsa, and then we went to OSU to party it up with their... No, it had to have been... I'm going to take it back. It was fall break because it was their homecoming at OSU. So they're the Cowboys, mm-hmm. Oklahoma State University Cowboys. And so we went and got our party on at OSU for a weekend.
Nice.
So that was fall break. Yeah, so that was my time in Oklahoma. And then one time I drove and picked up a friend from Oklahoma City when his Greyhound bus stopped there and he couldn't get to our school. So he called me and was like, hey, can you come pick me up in Oklahoma City? And I'm like, okay.
How long of a drive is that?
Probably 4 hours.
Kansas or from?
Yeah, Kansas. So Kansas from about Wichita.
Okay.
To Oklahoma City. It's just right down the I-35. So it's a straight little jaunt. And anybody who lives in the Midwest, 4 hours is nothing. When you're driving. I know you don't like it, driving those distances, but...
Honestly, I don't mind. I lived in Southern California for a bit, so...
Excuse me, miss. When we were driving for your bachelorette party, you couldn't stand to be in the car for 3 hours. You
were That's going different, because there was bananas. Something so exciting waiting for me at the end. Yes, so we're in Oklahoma this week. I have never been to Oklahoma, and after we hear my story, and probably yours too, since they're both about massacres, I don't know how much I want to go to Oklahoma. Doesn't sound like the safest place, but I mean, I guess it's not the 1920s anymore, so maybe it's a little better.
Yeah, I have friends from there, so I'm not going to say all Oklahomans are bad.
So, but at least the ones in May of 1921 were terrible.
So, yeah. Okay.
All right. So we'll jump right in because I have a feeling we got a lot to talk about this week.
We do have a lot to talk about. So I'll get started as I normally do. Today I'm going to be sharing about the Osage Indian murders. So some call them the massacre, others call it the Reign of Terror. So this is, it's like, holy shit, because the Reign of Terror for me is in France when everybody was getting guillotined if they were royals. So this is, I guess, America's Reign of Terror.
Oh my goodness, that sounds like a theme park ride that you do not want to get on if you are under the age of like 13.
Yeah, it's not like the, yeah, it's not the Tower of Terror.
No, not that sounds way more frightening.
Yeah. So I would need more than one episode of this podcast to talk about all of the murders that occurred against the Osage tribe. But this week I'm going to focus on Anna Brown and her family. To better understand what was happening around the time that Anna was murdered, you have to know just a little bit of history on the Osage tribe. So I'm going to give you guys pre-warning here. I am skipping a lot of beautiful history about this tribe because, you know, they were here first and they have, you know, thousands of years of history. So this is just very, very quick synopsis. Doesn't tell about all the other horrible things really that befell them when Europeans came around. So just keep that in mind, okay? So I'm not giving the whole story here. So the Osage is one of the Midwestern Great Plains tribes. They moved from the Ohio River Valley to the area. Also, precursor, I've been drinking a little beer tonight.
It's a rough episode we're getting through.
So my face is red, so Selena gets to look at my little red beet face because that happens when I drink. Okay, so they moved from the Ohio River Valley to an area west of the Mississippi River around Missouri. Now, the first time they moved from the Ohio River Valley to kind of the Missouri area, it was due to the Iroquois tribe from more of eastern kind of encroaching in their area and warring with them. However, as most people know their American history, the plight of Native Americans was not a very happy one. So when the Midwest started to be, and I'm putting this in quotation marks, settled, which it already was, let's be real, with the idea of manifest destiny, which we should hopefully know what that is. So that was, you know, my people's coming across and moving and taking over Native American lands. The Osage tribe was no different. They were forced to move multiple times from their land to different Indian territories. Now, the Osage tribe, actually, just I didn't write this in my little synopsis here, but they did help fight in the Civil War for the North. So just so we know that. So after the Civil War, during the Reconstruction era, the Osage ended up selling their land in Kansas in the Missouri area to the government. And then they ended up buying their reservation land in the Indian Territory, which they're one of, I think they're the only tribe that actually purchased their reservation. So everybody else just moved on it and then the government had all the say, but they actually owned the land that they were put on. And their reservation territory is now known as Osage County, Oklahoma. So this was around the 1870s when that all happened. Now, just because they owned their reservation doesn't mean that they were treated fairly, because that is far from the case. By the beginning of the 20th century, though, the U.S. government wanted to make Oklahoma a state. So it wasn't a state yet. It became a state in 1907. So the U.S. government decided that they wanted Native Americans to assimilate. So, you know, act more white, become more white, dress more white, go to schools like white people, you know. Totally get rid of their culture.
Oh, they were going to let them go to school and do all that. Look at that.
Well, they did do that. They used to steal, like, this isn't from, this is just from my being a history major. Mm-hmm. They used to take the kids off of the reservations and force them into schools.
Wow.
So, yeah.
I mean, how interesting them, that they...
Because they wanted to make them less savage. And so that was how they tried to do it, was that they were then put into white people's homes. And so now we have ICWA, which is for Indian child welfare laws, to make sure that they have more say and more rights over their children.
Oh, okay. How interesting, though, that white people are like, okay, Indians, we're going to educate you and we're going to try to assimilate you, but black people, nah. Like, I don't know. That just seems weird to me. Because it's not like Native Americans are white, you know what I mean? It's not like they look or like that they would fit in
better. I do think that there was a hierarchy when it came to that, and white people are at the top, obviously, for them. And then it went down from there. So I think in a lot of people's minds, maybe Native Americans might have been a step above.
Okay.
So I think that there was a little bit of that going on. So because the government wanted to make the Indian territories into Oklahoma, they ended up passing the Curtis and Dawes Acts. And these were two acts that provided allotments of land, giving each Native American family 100 acres. So this was for all tribes in the Indian Territory because it wasn't incorporated into the United States yet. And so it was kind of not even deemed part of America in a lot of ways. So to turn Oklahoma into a state, they needed to dismantle the reservations. And so all of the tribes were then given those allotments. So that 160 acres was for each family. So not each person, each family. And then they took, after they gave them all the 160 acres, they took then all the surplus land and sold that to non-Native American families. So totally screwing over the tribes yet again. But the Osage tribe was different because they had purchased their reservation outright from the government when they were moved there in the 1870s. They owned that land. Sadly, they were still forced into allotments. However, their surplus land after the 160 acres was given to each family wasn't sold. It was still part of the tribes. So each person, not each family, each person received 657 acres of land. So substantially more than any other Native American tribe got during that time. And along with owning the land came something called head rights. So this is like head rights were used when Manifest Destiny. I don't know if you ever saw the movie Far and Away with Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise, and they're from Ireland. And at the end, they ring, like they blow a whistle, and then everybody like rushes to claim plots of land. And then you have to improve that land over a certain amount of time, and then it becomes yours. So head rights are kind of go along with that. So if you improve that land, then you get the head right to it, and it can be then passed on from generation to generation. So a lot of farmland homesteads were made from that. So I know like in Nebraska, that also happened. And some of my family members still own the land that their families originally homesteaded on. So with the 657 acres for the Osage, they got head rights to this land. So whoever inherited the land after they passed would be their like relatives or whoever they named as heir. Mm-hmm. Now, this land wasn't really great for farming, but you could raise stock on it. So cattle and stuff like that, because it was kind of prairie land. However, this isn't what made the land so important. In 1897, oil was first discovered in Osage County. In 1907, when the government decided to make Oklahoma an official state and they forced the allotments to happen, the Osage tribe still had the land where the oil was discovered. The Department of Interior leased the land for oil exploration and production. So each allotment was paid royalties for that oil production. However, head rights stated that the legal heir and their heirs did not have to be members of the Osage tribe. So they didn't have to be full-blooded. They didn't even have to be Native American at all. So that kind of plays a key point in this.
Okay.
In 1897, oil wasn't like the be-all, end-all. And even in 1907, oil prices weren't great. But by the 1920s, all of a sudden, oil was a hot commodity. So it was worth a lot more than it had been previously. So just to give you an example, the Osage tribe in 1923's royalties amounted to $30 million in those days, which turns out to be $400 million in today's day and age. That's just 1 year of the oil.
Oh my goodness.
So at that time, the Osage tribe was now the richest nation, because they're considered, you know, kind of their own sovereign kind of people, or social group in the entire world.
Wow. That's so crazy.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah. So a lot of money coming in. Of course, all this wealth brought other people to the area. Not shocking. Mm-hmm. So if we think back to that time and before, the opinion of the government really wasn't that favorable towards Native Americans or anyone really that was of color. So in 1921, Congress passed a law requiring courts to appoint guardians for each Osage tribal member that was half blood or more. So the courts, were forced to, well, not forced. So they started appointing all these guardians to every single member. And these guardians were chosen by the court. And they, of course, were the local lawyers and businessmen surrounding in Osage County.
Of course they were.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you can guess what kind of men were drawn to this and what happened to all the royalties and head rights. So
yeah.
This brings us to Anna Brown and her family. So Anna was, okay, so I've seen a couple of different facts, and just so you know, I don't know what to go on. So some say that she was 25 in 1921. Some articles said that she was 36. So a pretty wide discrepancy in age.
Yeah.
I don't know which to go by. So she was around 25 to 36 years old in 1921. She was divorced, and her immediate family consisted of her mom, Lizzie, her sister, Rita, and her sister, Molly. Anna had previously married and divorced a white man. Molly was married to another white man named Ernest Burkhart, and her sister Rita was married to another white man named Bill Smith. Now, it wasn't uncommon at all in that area for Osage women to marry white guys. Just, I think we'll find out why in a little bit. Anna's father had actually passed away a couple years prior, and she also had a sister named Minnie who previously, a couple years before 1921, died of a wasting sickness, and we will talk about the wasting sickness, and I'm putting that in quotation marks.
Okay.
I think what they, like, back then, wasting sickness, I think, was alcoholism, is what
that's
they
what I was
going to
guess.
Just so you know, yeah. I don't know, but that's what they kept calling it. So Anna was a really outgoing, vibrant young woman. However, in 1921, her family became concerned because she started staying out all night and she kept going to all these speakeasies, and she ended up actually starting to date Brian Burkhart, who was the brother of Molly, her sister's husband.
Okay.
So the family was very uneasy when one night she didn't come home, and it would take 3 days for her body to be discovered.
Oh my goodness.
On May 27th, 1921, a group of hunters came across the decomposing body of Anna Brown in a ravine in Osage County. When police first looked into her death, they thought her death was caused by alcohol poisoning. It wasn't until the undertaker took a look at Anna's body and found out that she was actually shot in the back of her head. Anna's wasn't the only body discovered that day. Charles Whitehorn, also a member of the Osage tribe, was discovered nearby, not like right next to each other, but like close enough that some people were kind of like, this is kind of a coincidence. So Charles was actually Anna's cousin. Charles was really well known in the community and apparently very popular. Both Anna and Charles were shot in the back of the head, and the bullets appeared to be very similar. So I'm not quite sure in 1921 how much ballistic evidence they were taken. Probably not a lot.
Yeah.
Especially since the cops at first were just kind of like, oh, she died from alcohol poisoning and fell down the ravine, which obviously didn't happen.
Yeah.
So the news of their murders was a hot topic around the county. Who could have killed these two? It was obvious to anyone that they were linked due to how they were killed, when and where they were killed. So it was just too close.
Mm-hmm.
As we were talking about before, head rights are very important when the person passes. Anna's head rights went to her mother, Lizzie, as she was her closest kin. Lizzie now had control of not just her own royalty head rights, but her husband who had passed and her two daughters who had passed. So I think they said 1 year, she was making like $2 million.
Jesus. Which,
yeah. So, I mean, that's a lot of money now. So back in 1921, that's a shit ton of money. Molly became the family's liaison with the police, as she was one of the only members that actually spoke English. And she was married to not just any white guy. So Ernest was the nephew of a man named William Hale, he was considered one of the most prominent men in Osage County at that time. Hale was a cattleman, and he pretty much had all the politicians and everybody in his pocket. Hale vowed to Anna's family that he would make sure that justice was found. By July of 1921, the murderer hadn't been identified, and the police wrapped up their investigation by just stating it was done by unknown parties.
Oh, so, my goodness.
They're like, okay, done.
Done. So, Jesus.
Yeah. Okay. However, not long after this announcement, Lizzie died from a wasting illness similar to that of her daughter, Minnie. So after Lizzie's death, Rita's husband, Bill, started to become very suspicious as a number of other Osage tribe members had also died from this wasting illness. And there was the murder of his sister-in-law that hadn't been answered to. Mm-hmm. Sadly, this wasn't the last of the murders to happen. On February 6, 1923, Henry Roanhorse, another of Anna's cousins, was found shot to death in his car. He had also been shot in the head. So on March 10th, 1923, a 5-gallon nitroglycerin bomb went off in a home in Fairfax, Oklahoma. It was in the home of Anna's sister, Rita. Rita and her servant, Nellie, died instantly in the bombing. However, Rita's husband, Bill, survived the blast, but died from his injuries 4 days later. Prior to his death, however, he was able to give a statement to the police on who he suspected were the murderers. So if you remember, after Lizzie died in 1921, mm-hmm. Bill was already kind of going, what the hell is going on here? This is not right. So I think he was starting to look into it. Mm-hmm. So 13 other full-blooded Osage men and women died, and over 60 wealthy Osage had been killed. So you had the 13 full-blooded, and then 60 that weren't full-blooded Osage had been killed, and their head rights had been inherited or given to their guardians, which were all local white lawyers and businessmen. So this happened So this happened in a short period of time, like in a 3-4 year period of time. However, there is suspected that there could be hundreds. So these are just the ones that they know of. But a lot of people died from this wasting illness. There's another little discrepancy here. Some say this happened in 1925 and some say in 1923. I'm going to go with the 1923 because I don't see that the tribal elders would wait 2 years after all of these murders happened for them mm-hmm. to reach out for some assistance. I just don't see that happening. So mm-hmm. all the ones that said 1925, I'm going to poo-poo and I'm going to say this happened in 1923. So mm-hmm. in 1923, tribal elders started going, what the fuck, not trusting the local authorities, reached out to a new department that was just getting started, the Bureau of Investigation, which would later be named the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Nice. This was to be their very first big case, and one that the FBI, so I got all my information, there was on FBI.gov, they have this part of their history, okay. Wikipedia, and then a couple of blogs, and then there's a book. So I'll list all of that on our blog where I got all this information. So this was their first big case, and also one that they have stated has been one of their most difficult cases to date in, what, their almost 100 years of being around. The tribal council had already had a suspect, the well-respected rancher William Hale. So if you remember, Hale's nephew was married to Molly, Anna's sister. Anna had been dating his other nephew, Brian, so they seemed to have the most to gain from all of Anna's family dying so that they would be able to get their head right. The FBI sent 4 undercover agents, and it would take them over 2 years of working undercover to discover what they called a crime ring in Osage County, which they found was all led by Hale. A little bit about Hale. Hale's originally from Texas. He and Hale moved with his 2 nephews to work the oil fields. And once they got there, they sort of noticed that all of these Native Americans were super wealthy. And so they were like, okay, I want to get me some of that. So Hale told Ernest that he needed to marry one of them. And so Ernest ended up marrying Molly. And then they began to arrange the murders of her family one by one. Hale even took out a life insurance policy out on Henry Roanhorse for $25,000, which he ended up collecting after his death. After interviewing more than 150 people, there wasn't really a lot of evidence gathered by the FBI. However, in January of 1926, the FBI brought Ernest Burkhart in, and he ended up confessing to everything. The scheme to wed Molly and kill her relatives, he admitted that they had shot or poisoned them. So that wasting illness was actually poisoning the whiskey that they were drinking. Mm-hmm. And so it just slowly killed all of these Native Americans.
Goodness.
So they suspect her sister Minnie had died from that. Lizzie had died from that. And then there were just so many. So it was found that one of the bootleggers during that time, he was also investigated in it. So I'm guessing that that's why he was, it didn't say this, but I'm guessing that's why he was investigated, because he was a bootlegger. Mm-hmm. So he was making that illegal alcohol and bringing it in. So the FBI also found out that during this time of the investigation, Ernest was currently slowly poisoning his wife so that he could then become the sole heir of all of their royalties. So Hale, his nephews, and one of their ranch hands were charged with the murder of Anna's family. Hale was also charged with the murder of Henry Roanhorse and tried separately, as the crime was committed on federal land. And then there were two shooters that had been identified that had shot Charles Whitehorn. Their names were Ace Kirby and Henry Grammer. However, before they could get them into court to testify against Hale or his nephews, they were both murdered. So there was a lot of murdering and money exchanges going on during this time. And so there were many different trials because they weren't necessarily found guilty the first time. Mm-hmm. In 1926, Ernest pled guilty to being a part of the conspiracy. He was given life in prison for his role in the murders. However, he was paroled in 1959. And then, this is the kicker here, was pardoned by the governor, Henry Belmont, in 1965.
So he can get pardoned. Meanwhile, Carol Ann from the Nebraska episode can't get a pardon to save her life. I know. What the fuck?
Well, you know, they're wealthy. Carol Ann was not. Yeah. So Hale was convicted of the murder of Henry Roanhorse and was also given life in prison. However, he was paroled in 1947. And that was the only murder he was found guilty of. The farmhand James Ramsey was also found guilty of the murder. It didn't say if he was pardoned, but I'm guessing because he was a farmhand or paroled, not pardoned. But I don't think he got out of prison. I'm just guessing.
Okay.
So Brian Burkholt turned against his family and turned state evidence and testified against all of them. And I couldn't find out if he served any time for any of the murders, or if he kind of got, because he decided to testify against everybody, if he got off scot-free, I don't know. But it did say that he did play a part in Anna's murder, because he was the one who brought her over to the ravine, kind of lured her over there.
Yeah.
So as I said, this time in history has been dubbed the Reign of Terror. And while Anna's family has some answers, most of the murdered Native Americans in Osage County's deaths have never been solved. I mean, that's like at least 65 murders have been totally unsolved, so nobody knows. However, to prevent further crimes like these from occurring, in 1925, Congress passed a law that prohibited non-Osage County Native Americans from inheriting the head rights.
Good.
So they couldn't. And then in 2011, the Osage tribe ended up suing the government for mishandling their funds and investments, and they were awarded a $380 million settlement.
Damn.
A little happy news for them. So that is just little story of the Osage murders. So you could go further. I just chose Anna's family because somebody had been convicted for those murders, but you could follow and just read lists upon lists of other Osage Native Americans who had either had suspicious deaths or died from this wasting illness, or who are outright murdered, and their land rights, so their head rights, were given to their guardians. And then also questioning the fact that whoever, even the ones that were alive, what was happening to all their money?
Yeah.
And paying out the guardians, and it's just total bullshit. And this didn't, I mean, this happened like less 99 years ago. And so it's like, that's just crazy to me.
Yeah. There's always loopholes when dealing with the government and the shit that they say. Like, people always find a way to get stuff from...
Oh, yeah.
I guess disadvantaged communities. Yeah.
To take advantage of, yeah. It's just awful and irritating. And they totally set it up because they saw these Native Americans being above them. I mean, they were the wealthiest people in America. And, you know, we can't have that. And so,
yeah, like, that doesn't look good.
Yeah. How can we put that down and how can we stop that right quick? And that was their idea, is to kind of put like all these Native Americans into conservatorship. So,
yeah.
Oh my God. And so I didn't look to see, I'm guessing the Osage tribe is probably still pretty well off if they got $380 million in their settlement in 2011. Yeah. And there are still oil fields in Oklahoma that are producing. So hopefully all the head rights were returned to, probably not, but hopefully some of them were returned to their rightful owners. And at least like 1925, they tried to like change it because they did see that they were
that was happening.
Abused. But like, hello, in 1921 or like wherever, when they passed that law, it's like, you knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
The second you read about it, like without knowing anything, you're like, oh, people are going to take advantage of that.
Yeah, they're going to find a way.
So that's the history of the Osage tribe in Osage County, Oklahoma.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing. My story this week, and pretty much I think the reason we're moving Oklahoma to ahead of Kansas, is because it's recently come into the news a little bit more, and it's starting to gain traction in people wanting to learn about this. So today I'm going to be telling you about the Tulsa Race Massacre, which you may have heard of as the Tulsa Race Riots, but I think massacre is a better fit for what this is. So in the early 1900s, the area known as the Greenwood District in Tulsa, Oklahoma, was also known as Black Wall Street. It was built on the ideal that if Black people could pool their resources and work together, that they would have a strong chance at economic progress. So basically, everything in the area was owned and occupied by African American residents. And they would say that a dollar would be spent 10 times before, or be passed around 10 times before it would even leave the area, which is how good they were about keeping to their own and building up their own community. Black Wall Street was a thriving community in which many of the buildings belonged to African Americans. The area had grocery stores, churches, libraries, banks, doctor's offices, and tons of other thriving business storefronts, making it one of the most affluent African American communities in the country. So J.B. Stratford was one of the people helping make this happen. He was a law graduate from Indiana University who bought up a lot of the land in the area, and then he would sell them to African American residents so they could turn them into residences and businesses and kind of start their own. So he would sell them for reasonable prices. And he even ended up starting a hotel that I believe he named the Stratford after him. It was so that way Black people could be in a hotel that was high class and luxury and basically just like all the white hotels that they weren't allowed to stay in. And so he played a big role. There were other people who played a role, but he was kind of one of the main ones that I wanted to share because he helped buy up that land and transform it into something new. Because just like you mentioned in your story, the oil business was booming around that time. So it was bringing a lot of people in. By 1921, Stratford was considered one of the wealthiest African Americans in the country. Despite all the successes, however, Black Wall Street was still in Tulsa, which arguably had some of the harshest Jim Crow laws in the country. As it continued to thrive and prosper, many white residents in the area began to resent the community. As the physical boundaries of Black Wall Street began to grow, residents sent hate-filled letters to the business owners demanding that they stay within their boundaries and out of the quotes, white part of town. Poor white people in the area nearby became jealous of the successes of those that they felt didn't deserve it. So it's that whole thing of like, well, if I'm not doing great, why do they get to be doing well? And why should they have all these successes? Because they're black. And again, racism still alive and well in Oklahoma in the 1920s, arguably probably still alive and well right now, but hopefully not to this extent. So May of 1921, it would reach its tipping point. May 30th, 1921, 19-year-old shoeshine Dick Rowland rode the elevator in the Drexel building with the elevator operator, 17-year-old Sarah Page. So it says that this was pretty common because I believe the Drexel building was one of the only bathrooms that Dick was allowed to use because things are still segregated. So while they're in the elevator, Sarah screamed and Dick took off running out of the elevator. The police were called and Dick was arrested the next day. It's never known exactly what happened in the elevator. Some people, and I think ultimately what the police discovered was that he simply stepped on her foot, causing her to scream like in pain. Others claim assault, but it would be the Tulsa Tribune's front page story the very next day that ultimately swayed public opinion because their front page story claimed he had sexually assaulted her. By that
evening, such a big leap from like even like grazing against her or stepping on her toe to like assault. Ridiculous.
Yeah. So by that evening, an angry mob had formed outside the courthouse with white people demanding the sheriff give them Dick Rowland because a bunch of lynchings have been happening in this town. There was a lot of like vigilante justice going on in Tulsa at the time against white and blacks alike. When the sheriff refused to give up Dick, they grew really angry. The sheriff had his men barricade the floor where Dick Rowland was being held, hoping to avoid the history of vigilante lynching that was so common in Tulsa at the time. Around 9 p.m., about 25 armed black men arrived at the courthouse, many of them World War I veterans, offering to help in guarding Dick. The sheriff declined the help and turned them away. As rumors swirled around of a possible lynching and the white men storming the courthouse, 75 armed black men returned to the courthouse. When they arrived, they were met with around 1,500 white men, only some of them armed, but the sheriff again told them he had it under control, they could head back. As the group of 75 men began to head back to Greenwood, a white man from the crowd tried disarming one of the veterans in the group. A shot was fired, and the massacre began. Fighting erupted between whites, angry that there was no lynching, and blacks just trying to defend their community. The mob made its way to the Frisco Railroad, which served as kind of that segregation line between Black Wall Street and the white neighborhoods, and the mob began to attack. As people tried to keep the mob at bay, they soon found their way in. An unarmed black man was murdered inside a downtown movie theater. Drive-by shootings were happening in the residential communities as carloads of armed white people scoured the neighborhoods. By midnight, just a few hours after that initial shot was fired at the courthouse, fires began to spring up along the edge of Black Wall Street. As the fires burned, members of the mob began to plot an invasion of Greenwood at dawn. Where were the authorities? Turns out, Tulsa police officers began deputizing members of the former lynch mob and instructing them to, and I hate this word, quote, get a gun and get a nigger. I know. It's so frustrating. It took me a lot to write this story because every action that followed is just so much more infuriating.
Yeah.
Rumors began to add fuel to the fire by saying that nearby cities with large African American populations were bringing in reinforcements to help guard Black Wall Street. So then the community got even more aroused because they're like, now they're bringing even more of them into town, and they started building this mob. The National Guard, meanwhile, were mobilized to protect not the black neighborhoods currently on fire, but the white neighborhoods that feared a counterattack. So everything that has happened pretty much has been perpetrated by the white people in this situation, yet they're afraid that there's going to be a counterattack. When the only violence...
A bunch of fucking Karens.
Yes, right? Really, the only attacks being held were just defensive. Like, they had armed people around Greenwood that were trying to protect the community. They were trying to protect all these storefronts was the only reason. And I think someone said there was a machine gun there that they were using to kind of protect everything. Because remember, there's like some veterans in mm-hmm. this community as well. And that was it. They were just trying to protect their own. So early morning on June 1st, thousands of armed whites gathered around Greenwood. They scoured Black Wall Street and looted homes, looted businesses, then set those businesses on fire, and they murdered people without hesitation. They shot a man named A.C. Jackson, who was a physician in the area, after he had surrendered to them. And he was like a well-known physician in the area. Mm-hmm. People loved him. He even surrendered, and they killed him. People fought with all their might to protect their homes and businesses, but ultimately they were outnumbered. Buildings burned as firefighters coming to help were threatened at gunpoint by the rioters and forced to leave. Can you imagine, like, the fire department trying to just do their job and people pointing guns at them and making them leave?
Yeah, because they're like, no, we want to burn this shit down. We don't want you to mm-hmm. save it.
Mm-hmm. One estimate claims that 1,256 buildings were burned and another 215 were looted, but managed to avoid the flames. By 9:15, when the National Guard finally arrived, because all of this happened in the early morning of June 1st, so we're talking like 4 a.m., 1 a.m., like real early. Mm-hmm. So by 9:15, when the National Guard finally arrived and declared martial law, it was too late for Black Wall Street. They helped the firefighters put out the fires, but also ended up imprisoning the victims of the riot. Over 6,000 people were held prisoner, some for as long as 8 whole days. Dick Rowland was exonerated soon after the massacre ended, and he ended up just getting out, grabbing his stuff, and left Tulsa the next day.
Oh, yeah, because you know what would have happened to him if he would have stayed.
Yeah. And
he
so
been lynched.
They say that he never returned. There was nothing that said what happened after that. He just got the hell out of there. Despite a plethora of evidence, no white people were ever sent to prison for the murders and the arsons that were committed. And some of them were even tried and they went to court. I think there was a large number of court cases that ended up getting filed and none of them wherever.
Did they actually go to trial or no?
I think, or they might have just gotten dismissed pretty early on.
Either way, you know they weren't going to be found guilty.
Yeah.
Because they had their peers sitting on the jury. There was no way they would get convicted.
Yeah. So the majority of the African Americans in the community were made homeless by the events of that weekend. Because remember, that was not just a business district, but also there were residential neighborhoods near there. The government tried to force the community to relocate, but they refused and began the slow process of rebuilding what was taken from them. Still, many were forced to spend the winter sleeping in tents that year. An official tally of 36 deaths was given, 10 white people and 26 black people. Very few, if any, people were claimed to have died as a direct result of the fire, so something else happened before. The numbers were largely misreported throughout the years, with many media sources at the time saying the deaths ranged anywhere from 68 to 176. So tons of places kept reiterating that in the days following. It was like, okay, there were this many, now there are this many, now there's 75, now there's 85, now there's 176, now there's 179. It was just all over the place with the numbers. Walter Francis White, the leader at the time of the NAACP, traveled to Tulsa, and when he returned to New York, he claimed that it was closer to 50 white people and between 150 and 200 black people. He also stated that in his investigation, he discovered that people were told to bury the victims in mass graves without coffins, which is why there wasn't a whole lot of accuracy with the numbers, but later on, like probably around 2011, I want to say, they did try to use ground penetrating radar to try to figure out where this could have happened. But so far, there's been no evidence. And I think they've officially just kind of called it off.
Oh, so like they don't know where the burial ground is?
Mm-mm. In 1921, Red Cross records indicated that 183 people were hospitalized for gunshot wounds or burns, and they had to look at stuff because I guess back in the day, like the way that the records were noted, it's kind of hard to figure out, like everyone was just like triaged for certain stuff, but it wasn't clear as to what exactly their wound was. But 531 required first aid or surgery. There were 8 miscarriages as a result of the tragedy that weekend, and 19 died in care within the next 6 months. Property losses were around $1.5 million in real estate and $750,000 in personal property, which I did the math, and in today's rates would be close to about $30 million in damages. Governor James Robertson ordered a grand jury to be impaneled to figure out what happened after 12 days of hearing witnesses' testimony was given. And it did say that they, because I got a lot of this from like Wikipedia and the different website, like history websites about this, that they expected to hear from both white and black people that were there, but it never gave me a definitive, like, yes, they heard from both. So I don't know who the witnesses were. I would hope that it was a good mix since it was so large. You'd have a big sample size. So they heard from a lot of witnesses for 12 days. After that, the all-white jury found that the riot was due to the black mobs, but the police did fail to prevent the riot in the first place. So kind of, I know, I was just like, are you kidding me?
No, it's the white people. Like,
it's the white mobs. The black people weren't even in a mob. They were just protecting their homes.
Yeah. My God.
Soon, a committee was formed to help raise funds for the rebuilding of Greenwood. A former mayor of Tulsa, Jay Martin, who was at the time a judge, he became the chairman of the group, and he said this, and I quote, "Tulsa can only redeem herself from the countrywide shame and humiliation into which she is today plunged by complete restitution and rehabilitation of the destroyed Black Belt. The rest of the United States must know that the real citizenship of Tulsa weeps at this unspeakable crime and will make good the damage so far as it can be done to the last penny." Despite this promise, however, a lot of the funding was not raised and many struggled to rebuild. So like I said, a lot of them were waiting on those funds, and that's how they ended up sleeping in tents throughout the winter because it was just slow going at that point to try to rebuild. A group of white developers who were pretty influential in the area got the city to pass a fire ordinance that would stop the African-American community from rebuilding Greenwood. They wanted to use the space themselves for businesses and industrial stuff and force the African-American community further to the edge of the city. It went to Oklahoma's Supreme Court, where thankfully it was found unconstitutional. So why haven't we ever heard about the Tulsa race massacres? Because no one wanted it known. Decades would go by with no public ceremonies, memorials, or any mention of the tragedy that took place that weekend. The newspaper, the Tulsa Tribune, even, because I guess they would do things where it's, even to this day, I think would do stuff where it's like, oh, on this day in this year, and on this day in this year. So kind of taking you back to the news stories of the past, never once mentioned this during that Memorial Day weekend. So it would have been technically the 30th, because that's when Dick and Sarah were in the elevator, but the actual massacre happened on the 31st and the 1st. There's never any mention of it. The Tulsa Tribune also, since they basically incited all of this violence by claiming the sexual assault thing in the first place, had removed their front page story claiming that from all bound volumes. Police and state militia archives about the riots, they call them the riots, but the massacre, are also missing. A thesis was even done about the massacre in 1946, but it never went beyond the University of Tulsa. So it wasn't until a lot of scholars started researching what was going on and digging deeper into this that we even know about all of this today, because it basically, it was getting buried. Finally, in 1971, on the 50th anniversary, a small group of survivors had a memorial service at Mount Zion Baptist Church in the area. In 1996, the Tulsa Race Massacre Commission was created. It was originally called the Tulsa Race Riot Commission, but thankfully they had gotten it changed because that's all it was known as. It was known as the Tulsa Race Riots. Yeah. When, yes, there were some people rioting, but it was more of a massacre.
Yeah.
And so that their name was changed. They conducted interviews and gathered testimony to put together a detailed historical account of what took place. In February of 2001, they submitted the final report and listed their recommended actions. These included payment of reparations to the survivors, payment of reparations to any descendants, a scholarship fund for students affected by the massacre, establishment of an economic development enterprise zone in the historic district of Greenwood, and that a memorial be built for the reburial of the remains of the victims. So like I said, they never could find mass graves, but really a lot of places are estimating it at close to 300 people gone. Mm-hmm. But like I said, the number still varies because it's not like records were really well kept in the 1920s. But just based on the sheer amount of violence that was occurring, the loss of life had to be great. Because not only did all of the fighting start in front of the courthouse, but it even moved into the neighborhoods. And you think, like, okay, all of this started at 4 a.m. on June 1st, and the National Guard didn't show up, and everything starts settling down till like 9 a.m. That's a lot of time for people to be hurt. And even too, 6 months after people were in the hospital, people were dying for the next 6 months because of everything.
Yeah.
And so huge losses of life there. And then just the destruction. It's never been the same. The neighborhood hasn't. I mean, it's a historic district and they were able to rebuild a lot of it, but they could never match the success that it was. It was this thriving community and they were basically lifting up their own, you know, like they were investing in their community and growing their own little economy here. Like they were growing themselves, which is amazing. And I think it's what a lot of communities should do now. Like, I mean, we still talk about the importance of buying local and being a part of your, like growing your local vendors and your local communities. And they were doing it. And they're a model of how successful that was, like that they were really affluent in that community. And it's so terrible to hear that people got pissed and they were jealous and they burned it all down.
Yeah. It's disgusting.
Yeah.
So I had heard of this story, but I hadn't heard it. I think it was a couple years ago. I was listening to a podcast and it happened. Mm-hmm. Like that's the story that they told. And so as I mentioned, my freshman college roommate is from that area. Mm-hmm. And so her grandparents were alive and lived in Choteau, Oklahoma, which is right outside of Tulsa. Mm-hmm. And so they witnessed that. And so she grew up knowing about it. And I mean, we're Mennonite, so we're a pacifist. So I mean, hopefully they weren't, I'm pretty sure they weren't involved, they're pacifists. But it is something she actually learned about from her grandparents and her mom, mm-hmm. shared the story and just talked about how all of the communities there just totally wiped it from history. Like it had never happened. Mm-hmm. They denied it happening. So that's just so crazy that they're just like, nope, nope, nope.
Yeah. And they even tried to take it out of school, but like there's mm-hmm. a reason I never learned about this in school. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people never learned about it in school because it was one of those things that people just don't want to talk about because it was such a terrible thing that they don't want to admit it happened. And then too, that justice took almost to like, I think it was the 75th anniversary. And at that point, there were only 118 known survivors still alive, the youngest of whom was 85 years old. And now you're trying, and I mean, I guess it's better late than never, but still, like, can you imagine having to go through, like, hey, we're probably not going to get justice for this, and
yeah, well, and this isn't even the only massacre that happened around that time. So there's the Rosewood Massacre that happened in Florida, and have you ever heard of that? Because I'd never heard of it, you know, so, and that was another black town that was destroyed by white, so it's like, I'm sure there's more where it is like these, they viewed the Black people in the community stepping above their station and their right and being successful in any way, shape, or form, and had to have it brought down.
Yeah, and it took up until this year that curriculum on this event was even provided to Oklahoma school districts. And that's not even all school districts. That's just Oklahoma. And like, I get that we can't learn about every state's atrocities, but this is probably one of the largest massacres on American soil in history. Mm-hmm. And like, we have none of us know anything about it. And I think why it's becoming so relevant right now, actually, I know why it's becoming so relevant right now, is that the 99th anniversary of this just passed on May 31st, May 30th, I guess, depending on where you put it. I would say May 30th, because that was like the everything set into motion. But the day before the 99th anniversary of this, the George Floyd protests started taking place, and all of this started happening, and it brought to light, like, look at how this was in the 1920s and we're still fighting for these basic fucking rights today. Like, that is what these protests are about right now. Like, in 2020 we are still having to fight this shit. Like, we are still having to have these conversations of the simple fact, like, it's just the to have to try to explain the Black Lives Matter movement is the most ridiculous thing. Like, how do you not see that their lives are mattering less than everybody else's right now? Like, how do you not get that? And they have been mattering less than everybody's for years and years and years and decades and decades and decades. They have had to fight for this. And they constantly, they're constantly hitting walls with it and resistance and people telling them no. And it's basically like this, right? People are trying to tell them, this is your plate. Like, you don't deserve to be better off and you don't deserve these basic human rights. And it's fucking disgusting. And it is terrible. And it was even more upsetting to hear that this, it makes me want to throw up in my mouth a little to even call him the president, but he wanted to have a rally, which is basically a just shitload of propaganda, on Juneteenth in Tulsa, Oklahoma. If that's not the biggest fuck you to the African American community, like, I don't fucking know what is. You're taking a I don't know, would Juneteenth be considered a holiday? I don't know if it's something that is,
I wouldn't, like, say a holiday, but like, just having like a memorial or a you know, just
because I know it's like a celebration that it's commemorating the end of slavery, but I don't know if it's necessarily like, I guess it would be a holiday because you think of, like, I mean, Memorial Day, like, those are holidays, even though they're not these big joyous, you know what I mean? Like, even though they're about something kind of not, I mean, well, the ending of slavery is great, don't get me wrong, like, that's awesome, but the fact that they had to go through that, like, this, like, I don't, shit's so fucked up sometimes. This country can be a little fucked up sometimes.
Yes.
And I think what's just so heartbreaking is, again, there's so many similarities in what's happening, is like, people, they were still treated like the bad guy for protecting their own and for protecting the businesses and the homes and the lives that they worked so hard for, and people were still attacking them for it. And that's what's happening now, is they're just fighting to live and not be killed by police officers, and they're hitting resistance and they're being treated like the bad guys. They're being called rioters and looters and criminals, and they're not. These people that are out there protesting are not those things.
Yeah. And I think when you were telling, when you were talking about this and like talking about the whites going into Greenwood, and I just, and like, I just pictured pickup trucks and them driving in, and it totally reminded me of Ahmed Aubrey. And, you know, he was not where he was supposed to be, or encroaching in this white community, and all of a sudden here come these white trucks following him and shooting at him. So there definitely hasn't, I mean, that happened in Georgia, but there's so many similarities. And like, for anybody to say that there isn't white privilege and this is coming from me, I'm a white person, and we do have white privilege. We do have, I mean, it's been since day one in this country. You know, we used to count African-American Black people as 3/5 a person. And I think a lot of ways that thought and concept hasn't really changed. And mm-hmm. you look at Georgia now and their voting that they just had happen this week and the fucking debacle that was. And you're just like, that hasn't changed. And how, they made them jump through hoops to get voters' rights and prove that stuff that no white person ever has to prove. And I don't ever have to be afraid when I'm pulled over. I can talk back to a cop and not be shot. I don't have people, don't look at me and think I'm up to no good when I probably could be, and so it's just all these things. And it's just like, I don't get how people don't see that and that they're just stuck in their own bubble. Well, I take that back. Nebraska, some might not have an opportunity. I don't know. Like, I try to understand how they don't see it. And I mean, it boggles the mind, but mm-hmm. It's so frustrating. And when you see Facebook posts or when you hear things on the news and you're just, it's just disgusting, which is why I was drinking a beer tonight.
Yeah.
Just one. And but
but it is. It's so frustrating to see people not get it. And I think a lot of it starts with, again, going back to what the protests currently are talking about, the fact that we have to make systemic changes. And that's mm-hmm. what's it. It's so ingrained in people to discriminate that they just pass it on. Like,
or what they consider privilege, or like you and I were talking about in a discussion previously, just you and I, is that it doesn't mean necessarily that a white person thinks that they're better than or mm-hmm. more important or bigger than, whatever, than a Black person. It's just that, we're just like, history has given us way more advantages and opportunities while it continually takes the rug out from under any person of color. So mm-hmm. not just Blacks, but like any person of color. So we're talking about Native Americans tonight, and we're, mm-hmm. you can go back and look at just Hispanic, Latinas and Latinos in American history as well. It's like, there's mm-hmm. no opportunity where we're like, give them a push up to meet us. Mm-hmm. It's like, let's see how we can quickly take the rug out from under you if you have any sort of success. Mm-hmm. And we need to change that.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think, and hopefully this is one of those, I mean, I know this is history that's happening right now, but mm-hmm. my hope is that it's not just the history we hear about of, they tried and it was this big deal for a little bit, but nothing really came of it. I want it to be something mm-hmm. lasting, and I want us to start to make these systemic changes that need to happen. Cause it's like you said, white privilege isn't saying that white people are better or that they need to help Black people cause they can't do it on their own. That's mm-hmm. not at all. It's mm-hmm. that you guys are benefiting from a system designed to help you. And now we got to change the system so it benefits everybody.
Everybody,
And that it's helpful to all. And right now, that's not the case. That's not the system that we have. It does not benefit everybody. And it is not fair to everybody. Mm-hmm. And it's just so frustrating to hear. And like I said, it took me a while to really research and write this story because I kept getting so frustrated because you see this community literally building itself from the ground up, the dude I talked about earlier, he just bought land. Like, he didn't even buy a house at nothing. Literally, he sold it to people and they built it up from the ground up and were creating something wonderful. They were creating a community of their peers in a community that I'm sure they felt very safe in a very discriminatory place that they lived in. They lived in a really harsh reality at that time with Jim Crow laws and things like that. And they were making something for themselves, something that was theirs, something that they worked hard for, not something that they were given or handed out. No, they did this themselves. And how frustrating to see it get torn away in that way and to hear that they could never fully rebuild it to what it was. Because you think about it, that was people's livelihoods and it's just gone.
Yeah.
And now you have to try to build that up, something you've been building up for years and years and years, and now it's gone.
Yeah. And then not even really having an opportunity probably to even really fully recover, because not even that long, 8 years after that, you have the Great Depression started, and then you had the 1930s in Oklahoma where it was the Dust Bowl. Like, so there was like no way to really prosper after that. And if you would have just kept that prosperous, it would be amazing. It would have been amazing if we could turn back time and change history just to see what this amazing community could have built and become, and like the amazing people. Well, I'm sure the amazing people that still came out of it, but like just where they could have gone and taken it, and all these successful Black people, you know, just
And how inspiring they could have been to other communities, and how eye-opening it could have been of like, hey, we can do this. But then to go and basically like erase that history and then not even let people get inspired by hearing about it, like, hey, they did something great.
Yeah.
We can recreate that.
Oh, that's totally one of the reasons why they didn't want somebody to know that there was a prosperous African American community in Tulsa in the 1920s. Because that would encourage and give a blueprint on how to build a successful community. And that's not happening.
No, and it's heartbreaking, and it's, I think, even more, I mean, it's frustrating, but it's even more frustrating to know that it was almost like
100 years
having
ago.
That it was only 100 years. Bullshit, yeah, well. But also that the people in charge are almost making a mockery of it by having this kind of bullshit propaganda rally. And like, you know the effects, and yes, he moved the date from Juneteenth to what, the next day. That's still fucked up, and that's still so disrespectful. And then like there's a lot going on in the world right now that's messed up, but this definitely was one of those things. So I encourage you guys, read what you can, educate yourselves on these things. There's tons of books. I think actually we should link lists of recommended reading for what's going on right now on our website. So go check it out, educate yourselves, because obviously we can't really trust the education system in America. You gotta do your own research, and you gotta look things up. And I mean, not in a conspiracy theory sort of way, but like renowned like doctors and people who have studied this get to know their side of it, because this kind of history is really important for us to know, because 100 years later and we are repeating these things.
Yeah, it's repeating stuff. But I think also, like, I was thinking of change and everything, and I think I mentioned in Nebraska's episode that my dad marched with Martin Luther King, and I was reading a Facebook post of a guy who had also, you know, was through the 60s and, you know, changes there and walking with Martin Luther King, and he said the one thing that he's noticed marching now is that there's so much more diversity in the voices that are coming. And while there wasn't a near enough change in the 60s, I mean, segregation in a sense, ended. I mean, not fully, obviously, but there were changes in steps. So, like, hopefully this is another one of those moments that we're living in history where more voices are joining, more white people are joining and seeing, and there's more dialogue of having these hard conversations. So another person I listen to, I watch The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, and we talk about apartheid, and he lived through apartheid in South Africa. And something he said was that one thing that they, what needs to happen to make change and to accept change, is that you have to have those difficult, uncomfortable conversations with people. So we have to, a lot of times I think white people, yes, we see it, but it's an uncomfortable conversation that we don't know how to talk about and, or how to really address. And though we see it and we know it's unjust and unfair, it gives us the advantage. It's so such a hard discussion to have with a person of color because we can't put ourselves in those shoes. But those discussions need to happen because we need to realize, and I think the more we talk about it, the more people hear about it. So the more people hear about these stories, stories of people being murdered for no reason other than, you know, sleeping in a Wendy's parking lot and running away. So just realizing that there's unjust, and we have to have these uncomfortable discussions to make change happen. So that's what Trevor Noah says, and I like to follow what he says because I think he's wise.
And I think that's huge right now, is the importance of educating ourselves, having these conversations, admitting when we don't know something. That's okay. It's okay to not know everything or not know what to do or not know what's going on. But the first start is really just having a dialogue, learn something, take a second, listen to somebody. Again, educate yourself. It's the best advice I think anyone can give, is just to educate yourself.
Yeah.
And again, like, there are plenty of things that we don't learn about in history class, especially here in America. So take the time, do the research, get to know what's going on, and especially right now. So like I said, on the website, we're going to put some links, not only some places that you can help, but some educational resources as well, so you can look up some more information about the history, or I guess just really the history of what's going on right now in America and the systemic racism that's going on. Also, I think let's add some lists to some documentaries if you're interested to check out, that are pretty good as well. So so that was my story this week, and I know it's starting to get a little bit more well-known, but I thought it was still important that we talked about it.
I think so, too. Yeah. I definitely think so. Well, thank you. And this was kind of a heavy episode, like just a weighty, like, historical episode. So, but definitely something that needs to be talked about. Just like I said, uncomfortable conversations and uncomfortable learning has to happen. So thank you guys for listening in.
Yeah, and take care of yourselves after this episode. Do some self-care, some reflection, and just have a more positive rest of your day after you listen to this, because it's not all doom and gloom. Change is going to happen.
We're
fighting for it. So,
yep, hopefully in November.
Yes. There will also be a link to register to vote on the website.
Yes, please register to vote.
If you haven't already.
If you're not registered to vote, that is where a lot of change can happen, especially right now. So please register to vote. It's a right that not everybody has. And so we have to, if you have a right to vote, you need to vote for people who don't have that right to vote. And it's very important.
Yeah. Super fun state facts.
And cities.
There you go. All right. So we tried to find some more pleasant state facts this time, since our episode was pretty heavy. So I'll go ahead and start with my city fact. So my case took place in Tulsa, and Tulsa is the center of the universe. So there's a small concrete circle in downtown Tulsa that you can stand on. And when you make a noise while you're on that circle, your noise will echo back to you louder than the original sound. And apparently people outside the circle can't hear it. So it gets visitors from all over the country. So that's pretty cool. So if you're ever in Tulsa, head to downtown and check that out.
Yeah. When I was in Tulsa, I didn't go see that. I feel ripped off. Carenza ripped me off in our travels. I would have loved to have seen, have gone to that. So my city fact, as we mentioned before, mine happened in Osage County, Oklahoma. So that encompasses many cities, but I chose to choose the city of Pajoxa. I hope I'm saying that correctly, which is the county seat of Osage County. And if anybody watches the Food Network, you would know that the pioneer woman herself, Ree Drummond, lives there. And that is where her TV show, Pioneer Woman, is filmed. So you can go tour that building that her show is filmed. And then she also owns the Pioneer Woman Mercantile there, the boarding house, and P-Town Pizza. So they are all, and you can also tour the Drummond Ranch Lodge, so which that's where her network, her film, or her Food Network show is filmed. So Osage County. So just so you know, so just a little interesting fact there. And then I have the state facts for fact or facts, I guess, for this week. And my first state fact is, I don't know if, Selena, do you recall who the love of my life is?
Brad Pitt.
Yes. And Brad Pitt was born in Oklahoma.
That's the state fact.
No, that's not the only state fact, but that's the most important thing to come out of Oklahoma ever.
You hear that, Oklahoma? You gave Amber Brad Pitt.
So thank you, Oklahoma, for that beautiful gift. But actually, my Oklahoma state fact is going to be that shopping carts were first invented and used in Oklahoma when Sylvan Goldman, who was the owner of a Humpty Dumpty shop supermarket. I've been to a Humpty Dumpty. I bet you have it.
So I have not. That sounds like an interesting name.
It's a grocery store chain. So he came up with the idea to build shopping carts to assist his customers. And the first prototype of that cart was based on a folding chair. So, and on June 4th, 1937, the cart was launched, which apparently it was initially a flop. However, after some advertising, the inventor managed to influence shoppers to actually start using the carts. So now we have the ease of pushing our groceries down aisles. Thank you, Oklahoma, for making life easier and more beautiful, i.e. Brad Pitt, the sexiest man alive.
All right. So thank you guys for listening. Like we said earlier, make sure you take care of yourself. Today's episode was pretty heavy, and a lot of the events going on in our world right now are pretty heavy. So make sure you get a dose of some good news going on, or reach out to a friend if you're feeling a little down. That's totally okay. Make sure you like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. It's where we kind of update you when episodes drop and if there's anything new going on with us. If you have any corrections or anything you want to share or a case that you want to have us research for an upcoming state, then email us at stateofmurderpodcast@gmail.com. I also appreciate little virtual birthday cards. So let me know, because it's my birthday today.
Yay! So that's just a fun celebration thing for happiness. Thank you for Selena being born.
Aw, yay.
And next week, we will move up to Kansas. And then the week after that, we will be moving down to Texas.
Texas, the Lone Star State. The stars at night are big and bright. Deep in the heart of Texas.
Whenever I think of Texas, I think All my exes live in Texas.
Never heard of that before. I have not. That Texas sounds like a country song.
Texas is the place where I really long to be. There you go.
So I'm sure we'll sing a lot of Texas related songs in a few weeks. So yeah, so stick with us. We're going to be in Kansas next week and Texas the week after. We won't be announcing it because we already recorded the Kansas episode, so it'll sound like we're coming to Oklahoma, but we're not coming to Oklahoma again. We're heading to the Lone Star State. So, yeah, thank you guys again for listening, and
take care. See you later. Bye. Bye.